It's 5:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster, in for Rob Ferret. Later in the hour, we will take a look at President Barack Obama's push for new fuel standards for heavy-duty vehicles.
First, social media. For parents today, it's a new world that comes without instructions. From boardrooms to battlefields, everywhere you look, people are talking about social media. But the jury is still out on exactly how social media affects us and who's on the winning side of the social media equation.
Teens are key players in the world of new media. They grew up with it and intuitively understand the currency of likes, follows, friends, and pins. A new Frontline documentary that airs tonight on local PBS stations has branded these teens Generation Like.
The documentary explores how, in the pursuit of internet attention, teens are actually used by marketers and advertisers to sell products, from Oreos to movies to makeup. Generation Like airs tonight on local PBS stations. Here's a clip.
More than any generation before them, today's teens can speak directly to the artists, celebrities, and brands they like. And sometimes, they get a reply.
A couple of the other actors and actresses from the first movie have noticed me. Jack Quaid, who played Marvel from District 1, he was like my favorite actor. I don't know why, but I just became super obsessed with him. So I was like tweeting him, like, my only goal anymore is to get you to tweet me back. And he tweeted me like, oh, go check it off your list. Now go save the world and hurry. So that was really, really cool for me.
Does that motivate you to share things in the hopes of them kind of noticing?
Yeah, I mean, I've tweeted them a bunch of times, like hoping they'll retweet me and stuff. Because it's really cool, like, them noticing you. The Hunger Games official Twitter, they retweeted me and I gained like 60, 70 followers. It's kind of, you know, self-empowering to know that, like, oh, I'm one of like top fans on their website.
And we're joined now by Frank Kuehn. He's a journalist and documentary filmmaker for Left Right TV. His work has appeared on PBS, CBS, and the History Channel. He most recently produced Generation Like, which will air tonight at 9 o'clock on your PBS station. Frank, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks very much for having me.
So let's talk about that clip a little bit. Clearly, the teenage girl in question, who's obsessed with the Hunger Games, feels empowered by social media, like she is a part of the action, and she's a little bit famous herself. Is that the appeal for teens?
Oh, absolutely. You know, social media is an area where teenagers' interests and the interests of companies that wish to market to teenagers are really very closely aligned. I mean, she understands her role in sort of the marketing campaign of The Hunger Games. It's not as if she's being unwittingly taken advantage of. She just feels she gets something out of it, too. So she's happy to do it. So she spends hours and hours every day retweeting and liking and sharing and generally promoting, you know, content that is assembled by Lionsgate Movie Studios for a franchise that has earned $1.5 billion so far. And in exchange, you know, she gets the credibility amongst the her social peer group of Hunger Games fanatics.
How common is her story among the teenagers that you spoke with?
To a degree, her story is extremely common. She's a slightly extreme example, only because, you know, she has taken it to such heights. But on a smaller scale, every day, this sort of thing is playing out with teenagers around the country. Kids want attention. Kids want to be liked. And kids are trying to forge their own identities as they're growing up. And they're doing it in a way that's not radically different than, you know, when I was a kid in, you know, the late 70s, early 80s, you know, you would put posters on your bedroom wall, you would wear T-shirts of the brands that you affiliated with or the bands that you liked. You know, doing the same on your Facebook wall is not that much different, except that the Facebook wall faces outward to the world at large, as opposed to your bedroom wall, which was seen only by yourself and your friends that came over.
Now, you talk about the example of, you know, T-shirts or posters on your wall. Those things generally didn't have an audience of more than a handful of people, you know, maybe a few friends who came over to your house. Now we're talking about teenagers who have millions of followers, and it becomes sort of a cottage industry for them, and as you said, an advertising tool for the media itself, for people selling products and movies and entertainment. Isn't there a big difference between that and what we're seeing now?
Well, there is, but it's a difference of scale, you know, and it's a difference of scale that is empowered by this technology that allows that. I'm sure if companies could have broadcast, you know, used individual kids to broadcast their messages to hundreds or thousands or even millions of their peers, you know, in decades past, they would have. But you know, the technology simply didn't exist. Well, now it does. And companies have been very savvy in figuring this out and figuring out how to take advantage of it.
So how do they take advantage of it? How does it turn from, you know, just kids sharing stuff on the internet and social media into money?
Well, they take advantage of it by simply taking advantage of the natural teenage impulses, which is, you know, kids want popularity, kids want recognition, and kids have always wanted to interact with their culture, you know, and by their culture I mean, you know, the celebrities that they like, the TV shows, the movies, the brands, the sports teams, you name it. You know, kids have always wanted to reach out and be a part of that world. What social media does is it allows the youth culture industry, for lack of a better word, to create the illusion that kids can, in fact, be a part of it. You know, because it is interactive. In the clip you just played, the young girl who has interacted with actors from the Hunger Games movies. You know, this didn't happen with the Star Wars movies when I was a kid. You know, and if it did, I would have been absolutely starstruck the same way she is. So, you know, again, it's not a radically different impulse. It's that companies now have the ability to take advantage of it, to offer kids this fame by association in a way.
Well, I guess the question is, do you think that teenagers know how the data they're creating is being used? And do you think if they really understood it, that they would care, or they do care?
Teens don't understand how the data is being used. And the truth is that's because adults don't either. And in many cases, the reason for that is that we simply don't know how it is going to be used. The data is simply being created. You know, I think if you talk to people in the data gathering, you know, industries, they will say that they don't quite know what the future holds, but this data is there. So kids are not naive in the sense that they're not aware that this is going on, but they don't understand really what the data is going to be used for. And so to a certain extent, they don't really care because they've sort of grown up in this universe. You know, it's not like people our age who sort of approach the internet and it's something kind of new because I didn't have a computer till I was 25 years old, you know. And you know, so there's a wariness there. You know, these kids were born into houses that, you know, were online.
Well, let's look at another example from the Frontline documentary, Generation Like. A guy named Tyler Oakley, he has become famous on YouTube, and one of the things he does is he sort of shills products that he likes. I wonder if you could walk us through his story and how what he does has gone viral and is being used.
Sure.
And I was so happy I started getting views, which I didn't think was going to happen.
I'm sorry, we played the clip there, and I was actually wanting you to answer the question. We'll get to that. That's a different teen named Danielle
That's
Diaz.
A different one.
Right. But if you could tell us about Tyler.
Tyler Oakley is a person who I've never heard of before we started working on this documentary. But we actually met him at a marketing seminar in Los Angeles, and I was intrigued by the fact that a kid I had never heard of was lecturing to a room of corporate executives and brand managers who were all paying substantially for the privilege to hear him talk. Tyler's, I believe, 24 years old, and a few years ago, as a student at Michigan State University, he simply started talking on YouTube, making little YouTube videos as a way of keeping in touch with his friends. And he did it pretty consistently and persistently, and he's quite good at it. He's just a very engaging, very likable guy. And as happens in the world of social media, his audience grew beyond his small circle of immediate friends. He recalls the day where he suddenly noticed that 100 people had watched a video, and he said, "I don't have 100 friends." And he has kept doing it, and it is somehow, to his own surprise, turned into a career. Tyler is, sometime in the next few days, because his subscribership keeps growing, going to pass the 4 million mark, meaning he has a regular audience of 4 million people for his little YouTube videos. That is bigger than the audience for Frontline. We worked a year on this.
Wow.
4 million people aren't going to see it, but 4 million people will see Tyler's next YouTube video.
That puts it in perspective, huh?
Mm-hmm.
We're talking right now with Frank Kuehn. He's a journalist and documentary filmmaker for Left Right TV. His work has appeared on PBS, CBS, True TV, and the History Channel. We're talking about the new Frontline documentary called Generation Like, which airs tonight at 9 o'clock on your local PBS station.
And we'd like to hear your thoughts. Do you think that social media users should be more aware of how advertisers use the data they create? Do you think that this new kind of advertising is a positive or negative influence? Are you a teen or a parent? What restrictions do you have on social media? You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're back now with Frank Kuehn talking about his documentary Generation Like, which explores how advertisers use teens through social media to promote their products.
And we'd like to hear your thoughts. Are you a parent? Do you know what your teen is up to on social media? Are you concerned at all about the way in which social media data are used? You can give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org.
And Frank, I want to go back and talk about Tyler and the lesson there, which we were talking about before the break. You said he has more likes and more views than Frontline does. Does that translate, do you think, to power? Or, I mean, I guess in the balance of power, does something like Frontline, an established product, does it still have more power? How does that sort of play out?
Well, it depends what you're looking for. If I'm a company or a brand that wants to reach people in the demographic of Tyler Oakley's audience, which is predominantly girls, you know, between the ages of 12 and 14, then, you know, I see a kid like that who's got, you know, an audience 4 million strong, you know, and that's just on YouTube, never mind his Tumblr and Twitter and Facebook presence and all of that. That's far more appealing to me than Frontline would be. You know, it's slightly an apples and oranges comparison. You know, the point is that someone like Tyler Oakley certainly is important and influential within the world, you know, in which he exists, and companies and brands recognize that and they reward that.
Now, among certain generations, I'm thinking of the boomers, you know, I'm certainly familiar with the term, I'm not a boomer, but we might have seen something like this as selling out. You created an artistic product, in this case, you know, a video or something, and then you end up taking money and kind of dancing to the tune of an advertiser. Do these kids, do you think, do they care about that?
Not in the slightest. In fact, it was one of the more eye-opening things for us in making the film. Is we discover that in many cases, kids literally don't understand what the term means. You ask them whether they consider something to be selling out or what selling out means to them, and you get blank stares. It's not part of their vocabulary anymore. And I think part of it is that, you know, the millennial generation has grown up in a very different economy than us older folks did. You know, if I were graduating from high school or college in 2008, you know, I would not be too much of a purist about selling out, because, you know, the the economic obstacles that they're facing are much greater than, you know, we did 20 or 30 years ago. But also, they were just raised in this world of marketing and advertising. It's not something that is alien or even offensive to them.
And let's listen to another voice from the documentary, Danielle Diaz. She's an eighth grader who uses social media to share her music. Let's listen to a clip.
And I was so happy. I started getting views, which I didn't think was going to happen. So it kind of blew me away.
More people than you knew in real life.
Yeah.
And then how does it feel when you see, oh my gosh, another 100 people have viewed this thing?
It feels overwhelming. It's unbelievable.
And then the videos changed from just music to...
Just singing anymore. I like interacting with my fans.
It's funny to say it, though.
Yeah. It tingles.
Well, because it's new? But do you feel it's true, though? I mean...
Well, I've had comments on there saying, wow, Daniela, you're my idol. I'm your biggest fan. That was the first time I was exposed to the word fan. So I guess I can say I have one fan.
Interesting clip there from Danielle Diaz, who, you know, we said she uses social media to share her music, and she's gotten fans from what she does. And I guess a couple questions from there, you know, is this, do you think, an outgrowth of what has been called our celebrity-obsessed culture? Is this the sort of natural outgrowth of that and then the subsequent commodification of it?
Oh, and without a doubt. And, you know, the desire to be famous is not something that is new or exclusive to this generation. You know, I mean, my grandparents, you know, worship movie stars. But the, you know, it used to be you had to go to Hollywood to get famous. You know, you had to be discovered in Schwab's drugstore or whatever the legend is. You know, these kids have grown up in the world where, you know, all their lives, American Idol has been on television, you know. So the idea that you can be sort of plucked from obscurity and you know, presented to the world and become famous that way is to them not an unreasonable assumption. And so, you know, marketers and branders are able to play on that, you know, and kids willingly give into it because they genuinely believe it's true.
I guess, you know, the temptation is if you're not of this generation, you're not one of these teenagers who's on YouTube or someone like Danielle Diaz, the temptation is to look at it and to be sort of shocked at the new media landscape and to wonder if this is somehow unethical, if these teenagers are being exploited. Is there anything wrong with it, or is that just the way it is today?
Oh, well, I mean, that's the thing. It is just the way it is today. You know, it's we tried very hard in this film not to pass any sort of a value judgment on social media or on the kids that engage with it, because the truth is it's here and it's here to stay. You know, regardless of what the platform du jour is, you know, Facebook is big right now. Will it still be here in 10 years? Who knows? But it doesn't matter because something will take its place. And it's this interactivity that is, you know, what changes the game more than any particular venue of social media. And that's not going to go away ever. So, yeah, this is sort of the water that the fish swim in now, you know, and we just wanted to sort of point out what the water is like.
And the companies, are they upfront about their social media strategies, do you think? Are they transparent?
You know, the word transparent is one that came up constantly while making this documentary, but so many companies didn't want to talk to us about their strategies. It's not something that although all companies are to some extent engaging in it now, some more successfully than others, it's not something that a lot of them want to talk about. Interestingly, the kind of companies that were most receptive to talking to us were the actual marketing and social media advertising firms themselves, sort of the middlemen between brands and kids, because for them this is an enormously exciting time in their industry. They couldn't be happier to talk about it and explain how they do things, you know, which I think works to our advantage in the documentary. But the real powers behind it, the Facebooks of the world or Pepsi or, you know, these multi-billion dollar companies, MTV, you know, they didn't want to talk to us at all.
Well, Frank, in our last 30 seconds here, any predictions about where this could head next?
Well, that's almost impossible to foresee, because if you had asked me 10 years ago about social media, I wouldn't have had any idea what you were talking about, you know. So something will come along and change the game even further. But, you know, what I think we can all be sure of is it's never going to go back to the way it was. It's going to be like this or more intense in the future.
All right. Well, it's interesting stuff, and it's on tonight at 9 o'clock on PBS stations. Frank, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
We've been speaking with Frank Cuen about his documentary Generation Like, which explores how advertisers use teens through social media to promote their products. It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Ricker.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster, in today for Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up later in the show, we'll talk with two scientists about an upcoming effort to develop new classes of antibiotics that could fight everything from infection to cancer.
First, President Obama announced today he's seeking higher fuel standards for heavy-duty vehicles such as big rig trucks. The White House says these trucks amount to just 4% of registered vehicles on U.S. roads, but they account for 20% of on-road energy use and carbon emissions.
The president is issuing the orders directly to the EPA and the Transportation Department, as opposed to taking the matter to Congress. It's the latest action the president has taken in recent weeks in an overall plan to tackle climate change.
Here to talk with us about the new standards is Alex Guillen. He's an energy reporter at Politico. Alex, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
So what do we know about these standards so far?
Well, the standards that they're going to write, the news that came out today deals with vehicle model years after 2018. So we're looking at things that are, you know, we're not going to be seeing these models for quite some time. But obviously they have to start working on that now in order for the standards to be written and finalized before design begins. Mm-hmm. The extent of these standards, obviously at this point, are unclear. Just to give you a sense of the timeline, the president directed EPA and the Transportation Department to finish the proposal by March of 2015, so a bit more than a year from now, and then to finalize the rule a year after that, March of 2016.
And the president is also talking about heavy-duty vehicles here. What sorts of vehicles fall into this category?
It's a pretty wide variety, which also accounts for a lot of difficulty in writing standards for these. You have to consider a large variety of vehicles. But it's everything from school buses and garbage trucks to the fuel tankers and the 18-wheelers that you see on the highways all the time. Mm-hmm. They make up a relatively small percentage of the road traffic, even though for those of us who drive on the interstate, sometimes it doesn't always feel that way. But they have obviously enormous engines, and they make up a large percentage of the greenhouse gas emissions that come out of the transportation industry.
Right, and when I see those big rigs and those buses heading down the highway, I don't necessarily see new ones, or if they're new, I can't tell. So what's the turnover rate on these vehicles? How soon would we see a diminishing effect of the greenhouse gas emissions after 2018?
Well, that's difficult to say. You know, these trucks remain in service for quite some time, many years, decades even. But since you can't really go back and cut down emissions on already built vehicles, you know, you can really only look to the future. So how quickly we'll start seeing a drop-off in greenhouse gas emissions is unclear. It would obviously start in 2018 for these rules. And I should mention, of course, that in 2011, the administration finalized new rules for these vehicles that apply to model years 2014 to 2018. So we're really just starting to see those vehicles come on the market.
The EPA and the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration has to work with manufacturers, states, labor groups, and others, you write, and in order to work on this issue. That's a lot of buy-in to try to get here. How can they do it?
It definitely sounds like there's a lot of people involved in this, and there are, to be sure. But I think it's important to remember that the administration has done this before on two separate occasions, really. I just mentioned a minute ago the standards they put out a few years ago for the 2014 to 2018 models of heavy-duty trucks. Those actually have been fairly popular, and the American Trucking Association was heavily involved in that, and they supported those standards coming out. So, you know, there's not always a lot of antagonism here. Now, today, the American Trucking Association said they're a little bit more wary about these 2018 standards, but, of course, that process is really only just beginning. So I think as the trucking industry meets with the administration and they start looking at things that they can do post-2018, we'll get a better sense of what these standards might be and how the industry will adapt to them. And then the other instance I mentioned is administration also, in Obama's first term, finalized standards, new fuel economy standards for passenger vehicles, which a lot of people have heard about, that the goal is to get the average standard up to 54.5 miles per gallon by 2025. That was another instance where there was obviously a lot of coordination with the states, with the labor groups, with the industry, with environmental groups, that it all worked out fairly well in the end from most people's viewpoint.
So what resources will be made available to help this along?
Oh, what do you mean?
Oh, like financial resources to help the manufacturers and the states and others to start implementing some of these changes.
Right. Well, that's not something that's very clear at the moment. A lot of it does come through the industry. We'll pay for a lot of it. And so the point is, it's true that in general you're paying more for this the advanced technology and the new models, but the idea is that you're paying some more up front, but you save a lot more over time as your fuel use is cut down significantly. And so not only the idea is not only are you saving money on fuel costs, and obviously the trucking industry has lots of fuel costs, but you're also cutting down on the use of oil. The White House likes to point out that this could help cut U.S. oil imports. And it also, of course, cuts down on greenhouse gas emissions. The transportation sector is the number two source of greenhouse gas emissions in the United States. And the heavy truck industry is the number two source in the transportation industry.
Well, this isn't the first time the president has pursued tightened fuel standards. What else has he done during his tenure so far, both for heavy vehicles and the regular cars and trucks that we drive every day?
Definitely. The overall car standards that I said earlier, the idea is to get those done by 2025, or to have that average up to that 2025. The heavy trucking industry, like I said, we've already started to see some of these newer models on the market, and we'll see that coming online more and more in the coming years. And then, of course, right now they're working on the post-2018 rule.
Some are wondering why the president isn't taking this to Congress. Why is he taking this route of going straight to the EPA?
We've known that this particular move is coming for some time. Obviously, after they finalized the first round of heavy trucking rules that cover 2014 to 2018, the obvious next step is to cover post-2018. And also last year in June, the president laid out his big climate agenda, and this particular move was on that. He had a rather long list there of items. So why isn't he going to Congress? This isn't something he needs Congress for, it also helps highlight the whole theme, as he talked about in his State of the Union, of taking executive action where he can and working with Congress otherwise. So, the administration already has basically the authority to work on this. So that's why he's directing EPA and the Transportation Department to take action now.
Is there a concern that the added cost of developing new and more efficient vehicles would actually mean higher costs for things like trucking?
That's always a criticism that comes up. Like I mentioned, the trucking industry was on board with the previous standards, and we'll see what happens with these new ones. Obviously, there's no idea yet what exactly those are going to require. So the increased cost is always a concern, but the idea is that you save money over time on fuel standards, and theoretically, that does help reduce the cost. A lot of freight in the U.S., the majority, is moved via these heavy trucks. So the idea is potentially, it helps to cut down on the price of everything from, milk to anything else you might buy.
Well, what other efforts might we expect from President Obama in the remainder of his tenure here in the way of dealing with climate change?
The biggest thing the administration is working on right now would probably be the emission standards for power plants. They've already proposed new standards for future power plants, and that the EPA right now is working on writing a proposed rule for emissions from current power plants. So those are probably the number one thing the administration is doing on climate change right now. The electric generation industry is the number one source of greenhouse gas emissions in the United States after before the transportation industry. So he's working on that. There's a very wide variety of actions the administration is taking, dealing with international efforts with UN climate talks. There's a major conference coming up next year. And just this last Friday, the administration and the president made a point of going to California to discuss the drought that's happening there, the possible connections, to climate change coming out of that drought and other extreme weather events. So we're seeing a lot of focus on the administration on both climate change and helping to stop that and on adapting to what's already starting to happen to the climate.
Well, Alex, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Alex Guillen is an energy reporter at Politico. We've been talking with him about the new fuel standards for heavy-duty vehicles as laid out by President Obama today. According to some scientists, we may be entering a post-antibiotics era as resistant bacteria outrace our development of new drugs.
But a team of scientists is trying to turn that scenario around and bring about a new crop of medical miracles by mining the deep oceans for undiscovered organisms that could become new classes of antibiotics that could fight everything from infection to cancer. Joining us now to talk about that effort, we have Marcel Jaspers, professor of organic chemistry at Aberdeen University in Scotland and leader of the Pharmacy Project, and John White, who wrote about the story in New Scientist magazine. Marcel, thank you so much for joining us. Do we have Marcel?
Yes.
And I'm hearing someone. Marcel, is that you? Are you with us?
Yes, I am.
Excellent. And we have John White. John, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Great. Welcome to you as well. And Marcel, I want to start with you. Tell us, what is the Pharmacy Project?
It's a very large European project in which we try to go all the way from the beginning, from getting new bacteria from the deep sea and cold environments, and then turning them into interesting new antibiotics and treatments for other diseases, such as diseases of the central nervous system.
Now, you're looking in an extreme area of the world. We're talking about way below the ocean surface, an area that hasn't really been trawled that much for things like this, for organisms. What's unusual about what you're doing?
Well, really, it's thinking about where the next generation of drugs is going to come from. And in the past, people have looked at very remote environments, such as Easter Island, and found amazing new drugs there. So what we're thinking is that ocean trenches, which cover about 1% of the Earth and are deeper than 6,000 meters, so that's about 4 miles deep, and these are essentially isolated environments where life has evolved slightly differently. And by looking there, we think we can find bacteria that produce new drugs or new molecules that we can turn into drugs.
And John, set the stage for us, if you would. Why do we need to turn to such extreme efforts, such extreme places on the planet, like this deep sea sampling for antibiotics?
Sure. Well, I think both in the US and the UK, health officials have been sort of sounding alarm bells about antibiotic resistance in a range of infections for some time, and those alarm bells have only got louder in recent years. And the worry is that eventually infections that we can currently treat with drugs will develop resistance to all the drugs that we have to treat them. And it's a race against time to find a new class of drugs to put off this problem.
And there's a scientist that you quote in your article who says that in terms of new antibiotics in development, that the pipeline is pretty empty. Why is that?
Yes, correct. That's Laura Piddock, who is a microbiologist and who heads up a group called Antibiotic Action. So she is talking about the problem with persuading the pharmaceutical industry to pursue development of antibiotics. Clearly, getting any drug into use in humans is a very expensive process. And the problem with antibiotics is even if you do spend a lot of money to develop a new one, it will be used in a limited manner for the very reasons that we're talking about, i.e. if you overuse it, the infections you use it for will simply develop resistance to it. So, of course, the pharmaceutical companies can't really see a great sort of commercial benefit from developing these new drugs. So they've kind of dropped out of the race to an extent to develop these new medicines.
And you do say that about half of our drugs today come from organisms in the natural world. I wonder, could you just run through the list of some of the medicines that we use today and where they come from in nature?
Sure. I mean, ones that everybody have heard of, things such as aspirin, of course, which comes from the bark of the willow tree. Others that you won't have heard of, one called vinblastine, which is a chemotherapy drug, which came from a plant found in Madagascar. And there'll be numerous others, of course. Most antibiotics will come from fungi or from bacteria that are found in nature. And this is, you know, as I wrote, at least half of our current medicines are either sourced from nature or inspired by chemicals we find in nature.
Okay, and so with that backdrop, Marcel, when does pharmacy get underway and begin this expedition?
Started the project about 18 months ago using strains that we had in-house from similar locations. So we have bacteria, say, from Antarctica, from deep oceans already, that we started on. But the new collections will start this summer. So we have an expedition planned to the Atacama Trench off Chile, which is about 8,000 meters deep, so it's about 5 miles deep. And it's a unique environment. It's close to shore. It's very deep, quite cold. Of course, very high pressure down there. And as far as we know, it has a very high organic matter content. So that means that we expect to see quite a rich microbial life down there. And again, we don't know what kind of bacteria we're going to find, but we hope that they will be new. And the sort of evidence from other places in the world has shown that bacteria from the very deep environments can be very novel in terms of what they produce.
Now, as I understand it, one of the problems could be keeping these bacteria alive because they're used to a very specialized environment. They're used to extreme high pressure. How do you make sure they don't die on the way up or the way home?
So there's a couple of ways of thinking about it. I mean, some bacteria, so for instance, if I took a bacterium from the soil at the surface and put it under pressure, it would probably die. But there are strains I can get from deep ocean that are adapted to pressure in two different ways. One is to be able to survive only at high pressure, and there are others that can survive at all pressures up to a certain limit. And those are the ones we're targeting because we can grow those at normal pressures, we can grow them at high pressures, whereas the other ones that are specialized are just very deep and only survive at those pressures, so that we have to bring those up under pressure, and that's actually a very difficult business. So we're going to take samples up from the seafloor without maintaining the pressure, bring it relatively slowly and make sure that the temperature doesn't increase too much, because actually the bigger difficulty is to keep the temperature just right so they don't survive, they don't shock from 2 or 3 degrees to 20 plus degrees at the surface of the water so that they basically have a double shock. So we can, but what we've done in the past has shown that we can actually get bacteria to grow from sediments that we get from the very deep down oceans. That they survive, and we can put them back under pressure, and then they start to produce new chemistry.
John, this is not the first time that extreme conditions have produced new drugs. What are some of the other places that people are starting to search?
Yeah, that's part of what interested me about this whole story was that there are a range of extreme environments, not just the deep ocean trenches, that are being looked at and that have been looked at. But we're talking about places like the extremely dry part of the Atacama Desert in Chile, you know, where it's so extreme that NASA uses that kind of area to simulate the surface of Mars. Mm. So that's one place where they've been looking and where they've found a surprising variety of microbial life, which, although it's very early stages, they are sort of producing chemicals of interest, both possibly antibiotic and anti-inflammatory. I mean, the whole story about these kind of bacteria started out in Yellowstone National Park and the hot springs, which once again is another extreme environment. Very hot water, but once again, going back about 40 years, it was discovered that, you know, life was thriving there. and in fact led to the discovery of a very important chemical called what is a polymerase, which is used to amplify very small samples of DNA, and effectively that kind of helped to usher in the genomic revolution that we all know about today. But other places, there are pit mines which have become lakes, where they find, you know, in extremely acidic water, fungi that are producing chemicals that help fight ovarian cancer. There are sea sponges that produce anti-cancer chemicals that have been discovered. And there is the cave in New Mexico where, once again, fungi have been found, you know, living in sort of total darkness and pretty extreme environment. But once again, they're producing compounds that fight lung cancer cells.
And we have to leave it there, but it's fascinating stuff. And Marcel, I wish you good luck on your journey. And John, thank you for joining us today. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
We've been talking to Marcel Jaspers, professor of organic chemistry at Aberdeen University and leader of the Pharmacy Project, and John White, an opinion editor at New Scientist magazine, who wrote about that expedition.